Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
Change the healthcare system.
Insurance coverage.
Control these costs. $900 billion.
Abortion. Healthcare system.
Concern.
45 million Americans.
That's pretty cool, I guess.
Wait a minute!
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
At least this much is clear from the Church's stance. Health care for all, exclude abortion, protect conscience rights.
That's all I have to say about that.
Come look at this fellow on the radio. He looks just like you.
I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
You are correct.
All right, let's do it. And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, kicking off another week. It's going to be a big week, too. A lot of traveling this week, and looking forward to telling you about important things. The EWTN conference, radio conference this week. I'll be up in Boyne Mountain over the weekend. In fact, Teresa will be there, too, at the Marian Conference at Boyne Mountain. And, well, there's a lot happening, and just I'm glad to be able to sit down today for 2 hours with you, talk about the things that matter most. Columbus Day. Who would have thought, you know, after Columbus's grand mistake, that there'd be a whole new world? And indeed, regardless of what you think about Christopher Columbus's expertise as an administrator, he was not a good administrator. He was a great navigator. And he was a deeply committed Christian who saw himself in playing a prophetic role in the expansion of the gospel and the battle against Islamic encroachment. It's a fascinating story. And it's going to be told. I'm going to bring back Kay Brigham. This is an old best of segment, which is best of. We just think it's so good, we don't want to try to reproduce it. So you're going to hear that in just 4:20 today. Also, the mother of Columbine shooter, Dylan Klebold's mom, has now spoken out. First time that any of the Klebold or the Harris family has spoken out publicly on the Columbine tragedies, school shootings. We'll be talking to Dave Cullen, who I think is our nation's leading expert on Columbine. And then in the second hour of today's program, I'll have a few comments on why the little things can become big things, and why Mother Teresa, following the scripture, made it clear that we need to do the little things well, and the big things will take care of themselves. Also, be with Dr. Monica Miller. She was profiled in the New York Times over the weekend, and we'll be talking about graphic images of abortion. She'll talk about the history of the use of graphic images in the abortion battle, present an argument, and then want you to join us. It's a direct to my desk segment. It's a time when we can legitimately have a fight about, you know, strategy and tactics when it comes to protecting the unborn. So that's coming up in the second hour, and you're welcome to comment, of course, on the New York Times coverage. Two articles over the weekend looking at street-level activism by pro-lifers and the use of graphic images. So all that's coming up, but first we hit the headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you, Alan. A very good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. It is Monday, October 12th. The saint of the day is Saint Seraphim of Montegrano. Today's news is brought to you in part by Ascension Press. A Senate panel is expected to take a big step towards health care reform this week. The Senate Finance Committee is slated to vote tomorrow on a 10-year, $829 billion health insurance reform bill. Correspondent Terry Moore says it's the last of five Senate and House committees to craft health reform legislation.
Unlike other measures, the Senate Finance Committee bill does not include a government-run public option.
In his weekend radio address, President Obama again cited an urgent need for health insurance reform.
This moment will not soon come again.
And he responded to critics.
There are some in Washington today who seem determined to play the same old partisan politics, working to score political points, even if it means burdening this country with an unsustainable status quo.
There continues to be near unanimous Republican opposition to Democratic health insurance reform efforts.
The solution we settle upon should not be rushed, and the solution should not be worse than the problem we are trying to solve.
Florida Senator George Lemieux. I'm Terry Moore in Washington.
A South Korean news agency is reporting that North Korea has fired 5 short-range missiles off of its eastern coast. The launch coincides with reported plans to send the U.S. George Washington aircraft carrier to the South Korean port of Busan. North Korea recently said it wants to restart multilateral talks over its nuclear program. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the international community continues to work for a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. 3 people who were first responders at Ground Zero on and following the attacks on the World Trade Center died from cancer this past weekend. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says it appears their deaths are linked to breathing in toxic dust at the pile of rubble. He says federal funding to help those who are now sick is critical.
It's just another reminder that we've just got to get Congress to pass the Gillibrand-Maloney bill that would give us the money to continue all of the services we're trying to provide.
One of the 3 was an NYPD officer, Robert Grossman, who helped with the recovery and rescue effort on September 11th. His doctor believes that the brain tumor he later developed was a direct result of the toxic fumes that he inhaled during the weeks he spent at Ground Zero. Grossman died Friday at a hospital in Port Jefferson, New York. He was 41 years old. And a star-quality job seeker has managed to land 50 jobs. In doing so, 27-year-old Daniel Siddiqui met his goal of working 50 jobs in 50 weeks in 50 states. The former bioresearch firm employee began in Utah and finished at a winery in California. In between, he worked for the Border Patrol in Arizona and a wedding chapel in Las Vegas. He is going, of course, to write a book about the adventure. And now your fascinating fact for the day. Will Chamberlain never fouled out of a game during his entire NBA career. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. In Scripture, we're taught to have our senses trained to discern good and evil, good from evil. Discernment's a big deal. Discerning the still, small voice. We're told that he who is faithful in small things will be made master of much. And there is this theme throughout Scripture that the people, the ideas, the things we often ignore, are the things that eventually create a whole new world. And it's fascinating, looking over the history of the human race, that we do see this time and time again. Shockingly small things end up with big results. And I was spending some time over the weekend with John Lewis Gaddis's book, The Cold War, A New History, and I thought this is a great example. If you remember, all the experts, while they realized the Soviet Union was weak, none of those experts expected the Soviet Union to soon collapse. And certainly the KGB didn't, and the Kremlin didn't, the Politburo didn't expect that the Soviet Union was about to collapse. And the aging leaders in Moscow probably weren't following the fortunes of a scruffy anti-establishment rock band in Czechoslovakia called the Plastic People of the Universe. This group was formed in 1968 in the aftermath of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, where they put down a movement which was trying to present socialism with a human face. The Soviet Union said, we'll give you a human face, we'll give you a boot in the face is what we'll do, and suppressed the movement in Czechoslovakia. And this band of Elastic People of the Universe was formed in the aftermath of that Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And they performed in secret for years. They dodged the police, and they ran out of luck in 1976 when they were arrested. Well, it turned out this was a big trial in Czechoslovakia, and several hundred intellectuals signed on January 1st, 1977, a manifesto called Charter 77, which pointedly called upon the Czech government to respect the free expression provisions of the Helsinki Final Act, which the Soviets had signed, or at least, yes, the Soviets had signed. One of those intellectuals in Czechoslovakia was a fellow by the name, and a lover of rock music, a playwright, by the name of Václav Havel. He had spent 4 years in prison, and many more in close surveillance after his release. Well, this is fascinating, because here you have somebody like Václav Havel not calling for outright resistance, given the state's police powers, because it would have been a little point, you would have just crushed. Instead, he encouraged something more subtle. He called for developing standards for individual behavior apart from that of the state. You know, people who failed to do this, that is, people who refuse to live with an interior compass, moral compass, were confirming the system, were fulfilling the system, were cooperating with the system that was suppressing human creativity, human dignity, human rights. He said people who were true to what they themselves believed, even in so small a matter as a brewer deciding to brew better beer than the official regulations called for, could ultimately subvert the system. So when one person cries out, he wrote, when one person cries out, the emperor is naked, when a single person breaks the rules of the game and exposes it as a game, well, then everything suddenly appears in a new light. The whole crust seems to then be made of a tissue in the point of tearing and disintegrating uncontrollably. So the whole thing comes tumbling down. So this is Václav Havel urged not outright resistance, but this kind of development of an interior moral compass, okay, that went beyond the regulations for brewing beer. Okay. In other words, it subverted the system by being superior to the system, and also by affirming the individual's creativity. Now, Havel gave voice to the pressures that had been building up throughout Eastern Europe during that time, and it helped. He wanted to end that double life that Marxism and Leninism seemed to require, that you kind of had to have an interior life, and then you had to live your life in accord with the state at the same time. And all at once, a vision was created in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovakia in particular. A vision arose, once again, of a universal morality. Not a state-imposed morality, but a universal morality. And this universal morality was something that the state should obey and that the individual should obey. And at that point, God, or at least his agents, intervened to make that vision an unexpected, and to the Kremlin, a profoundly alarming reality. Again, notice little things here. Little Czechoslovakian rock band that can't even perform openly in public, for years performs secretly. They get caught. They're put on trial. The intellectuals issue this charter, Václav Havel among them, urge people to live faithfully to their highest vision of morality. And that this reaches a point. And then guess who comes on the scene? Guess who comes on the scene at this very moment? It's Carol Wotilla, accomplished actor, poet, playwright, athlete. He'd entered the priesthood in 1946, had been appointed Archbishop of Krakow in 1964 with the full approval of the Polish Communist Party, which had vetoed seven other candidates. You know, it kind of reminds you of Samuel, you know, going through the sons of Jesse and finally landing on David. Well, here they went through all these other candidates before the Polish Communist Party settled upon Karol Wojtyla. And it would be hard to find a clearer example of communist fallibility than their approval of Karol Wojtyla. Pope Paul VI made him a cardinal in 1967. Then on October 16, 1978, his fellow cardinals elected him at 58, the youngest pope in 132 years, the first non-Italian pope in 455 years, and the first Slavic pope ever. Remember, Czechoslovakia, right? The Slavic people now have a pope. And Yuri Andropov from was running the KGB at the time, said, how could you possibly allow the election of a citizen of a socialist country as a pope? He knew what was at stake here. And, of course, there was no good answer to it. The KGB didn't have an answer because they don't even control papal conclaves. So it became clear that the KGB, or the Polish Communist Party, began to recognize the danger, and they began to publish "The Pope is Our Enemy." That was issued shortly before John Paul II made his first visit as pontiff to his home country of Poland. This is what was said. He is dangerous because he will make Saint Stanislaw, the patron saint of Poland, a defender of human rights. Our activities designed to atheize the youth not only cannot diminish, but must intensely develop. In this respect, all means are allowed, and we cannot allow any sentiments. Take my advice, Brezhnev told Polish party leader Edward Gierek. Don't give him any reception. It'll only cause trouble. Gierek says, we got to, you know, he's the first Polish pope. We're going to have to give him a reception. And Brezhnev says, well, do as you wish, but be careful you don't regret it. Well, of course, when John Paul II kissed the ground at the Warsaw airport on June 2nd of 1979, he began the process by which communism in Poland and ultimately everywhere else in Europe would come to an end. And it's amazing, again, the small things that eventually led to the collapse of Soviet-style communism. I'm Al Cresta.
You now have two great Detroit area locations for religious merchandise. There's A. Mateo Church Supply in Garden City and now G.A. Fuchs Church Supply in Madison Heights. Between the two stores, they offer the largest selection of religious merchandise in southern Michigan, with everything from statuary, rosaries, and crucifixes to a large inventory of books. If you need it for your religious group or services, they have it. A. Mateo and G.A. Fuchs Church Supply. Just choose the location closest to you. You'll find A. Mateo Church Supply on Ford Road, just east of Merriman Road in Garden City. If you'd like to call for more information, the number is 734-513-2950. Write it down, 734-513-2950. If you're closer to Madison Heights, you can stop at G.A. Fuchs Church Supply on Stevenson Highway, just south of 14 Mile Road, off I-75. You can call them at 248-589-0200. You'll want to write that one down, too. 248-589-0200. They look forward to serving you.
The Ave Maria CD library continues to grow. As we begin our new season, we look forward to a number of delayed conference broadcasts on our new Sunday afternoon program, Your Catholic Conference Collection. We start by going back to Authentic Catholic Femininity from last spring. This two-CD set with Teresa Tomeo, Genevieve Kinnicky, Bishop Daniel Flores, and Father John Ricardo was $19. Tom Lowe and I broadcast the installation mass of the new ordinary of the Diocese of Saginaw, Bishop Joseph Sistone. That two-CD set is also $19. All editions of Christ in the Afternoon, Catholic Connection, Christ is the Answer, Putting on the Mind of Christ, The Doctor is In, and Heart, Mind, and Strength are also available. All single talks and programs are on high-quality CDs and are $9.50 each. To place your order for one of these titles or to inquire about a talk topic of interest to you, call 734-930-4506. 734-930-4506 or write orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Well, on this Columbus Day, we find out more about Christopher Columbus the Franciscan. Kay Brigham is our guide. Kay's a researcher, speaker, author, historian, researched Columbus's own writings, most especially the Book of Prophecies, which she looked at the Cathedral Library in Seville, Spain. She's written several books on Columbus, including Christopher Columbus's life and discovery in light of his prophecies. And she discusses at length his motivation and his spirituality. Kay joined me a few years ago, and I thought this was an interview worth hearing again on this Columbus Day. Join me is Kay Brigham, historian, speaker, author. She has researched Columbus's own writings, and most especially the Book of Prophecies, at the Cathedral Library in Seville, Spain. She's written several books on Christopher Columbus, including Christopher Columbus, His Life and Discovery in the Light of His Prophecies. And Kay, it's good to talk with you once again. Thank you very much for joining me.
I'm delighted to be with you again, Al.
Well, let's take a look at Columbus. He has become a much maligned figure, in at least in Western historical discussion. Does he deserve to be looked upon as, you might consider, the carrier of the evils of European society to this new world?
I've been speaking to school children all last week about Columbus and challenging them to discover the real Christopher Columbus. And of course, I believe as a historian that the way to know the real Christopher Columbus is to study the primary documents.
Mm-hmm.
And in his case, there is an abundance of his letters and ship logs and this extraordinary writing that he called the Book of Prophecies, in which he clearly shows his motivations, his vision of history, and his argument in support of his idea, the great enterprise of the Indies. And so I challenge people who want to know the real Christopher Columbus to read these documents and judge for themselves and listen to what he says about himself and his motivation.
How much material is there in the Book of Prophecies? Is it a lot of stuff?
It's a lot. Over the course of a number of years, and the work was finished in 1502 after his third voyage, he was collecting or compiling authoritative writings and prophecies from the scholastics, from the church fathers,
mm-hmm.
and from the Vulgate Bible, which he knew very well. And with the help of his friends who were monks in the monastery at Seville, he put together a notebook or a collection of all these scholastic writings and Bible prophecies that he thought related to his voyages to the New World, in order to convince the King and Queen of Spain that they had a wonderful opportunity to be a part of a divine plan that had been prophesied in these authoritative writings. And so he presented these writings just before his fourth voyage to Ferdinand and Isabella in order to receive the financing for his voyages. And he convinced them that Spain here had a messianic mission to take the gold that he found in the Indies to finance a great crusade to free the Holy Land from the Muslim domination of that day. He also believed that this would usher in the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem and the second coming of Jesus Christ and the fulfillment of the great prophecy of Isaiah concerning the new heavens and the new earth. So his vision of history was lofty. And the modern mind finds it very difficult to understand Columbus because he was a product of the Middle Ages and of the scholastic studies. And he had a rather mystical idea of history. But he believed with all his heart that God had appointed him as a special, a chosen vessel to fulfill God's plan in history. He thought of himself as a David figure who would conquer Jerusalem and free the city from the Muslims. And the queen, who had a very similar spiritual outlook as Columbus, understood his mind and agreed to finance and support him.
Now, this is, I mean, he had written that God had made him the messenger of the new heaven and the new earth. I mean, that's the way, that was his own self report.
Yes.
I mean, he really saw himself as part of an unfolding divine plan. And yet, normally, when people talk about Columbus, you know, at the most basic level, they think, oh, well, Columbus, what really moved him? He wanted to set out to prove that the earth was round.
Well, no, that was not the reason he set out, because educated people of his day knew that the earth was round.
Yeah, I know.
He knew that. That was no problem. That was already known by the great Portuguese navigators and educated people in Europe who had studied the geography of the Greek Ptolemy. So that was not why he set out. He set out because of an interesting situation in his day, and we should find that extremely interesting looking at it from our day and our situation. From the beginning of the 11th century, Christianity and Islam had been in a life and death struggle. And the Crusades that we've all heard about were established to free the Holy Land from Islam. And even in Spain, at the time of Columbus, the Spanish Peninsula had been under control of the Muslims for over 8 centuries. And in 1492, that year of destiny, Ferdinand and Isabella defeated the Moors in the final battle of Granada in January of 1492. And then by August of 1492, the King and Queen of Spain were able to really focus on Columbus's plan, which he had tried to present them for 7 years and had been turned down. And now that they had achieved a unity in Spain, a Christian unity, which was their policy, they now turned their attention to Columbus and thought, what can we lose? What if he does find a route to the Indies? Because all the trade routes to the Orient had been shut off by the Muslims. And so the Europeans were looking for new trade routes. The Portuguese found one around Africa into the Indian Ocean, but that was an enormously difficult voyage. And Columbus was convinced from his studies of geography books and some books that were precious to him, like Pierre de Ailly's Imago Mundi. He was convinced that there was a shorter way to reach the Orient by sailing west. Of course, he had no idea that a great continent lay between him and the Orient. But he died thinking he had discovered Asia. But that was the idea behind his enterprise of the great enterprise of the Indies, was to find a route to the Orient, to find the mines of Solomon and the wealth of the Orient that would eventually finance a great crusade to free the Holy Land from the Muslims.
And thus prepare for the return of Christ?
Exactly, because this would enable the rebuilding of the temple and would usher in the second coming of Jesus Christ and the Isaiah's prophecy of a new heaven and a new earth. Let me just read you a quote from a letter he wrote. He said, "Our Lord made me the messenger of the new heaven and the new earth, of which the prophet Isaiah spoke. and he showed me the place where to find it. So he had this enormous sense of mission. He quotes in the book of prophecies this from Isaiah, and he believed it applied to himself. Here is my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one, in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him. In his law, the islands will put their hope. I, the Lord, have called you. And in the book of prophecies, in his prefatory letter to the king and queen, he declared that the Lord had given him the gift of the spirit of intelligence, a spiritual intelligence that allowed him to understand these prophecies as it related to his mission and to the mission of Spain in the fulfillment of God's plan for the world.
Wow.
This is hard for modern minds to understand, but again, this was a medieval mind.
Yes.
And to know the real Columbus, we have to understand the context of history in which he lived.
With me, Kay Brigham, on this Columbus Day, historian, speaker, author of Christopher Columbus, His Life and Discovery in the Light of His Prophecies. She's researched Columbus's own writings, most especially the Book of Prophecies, at the Cathedral Library in Seville, Spain. We've been talking about his motivation, Kay. Let's talk about his accomplishment and his achievements. I'm especially interested in the missionary intention of Columbus. When he did get to the, quote, New World, what did he do that would be seen as, evangelistic?
Well, he discovered, of course, the Taino culture in his first encounter with San Salvador, one of the islands in the Bahamas, on the first voyage. And so on the second voyage, he brought the first missionaries to those lands, because it was the policy of Isabella, the queen, to evangelize those native peoples mm-hmm. who had never heard the gospel of Christ. You know, I would like to read the most wonderful engraving that I read on the marble walls of the Archives of the Indies in Seville, just across the street from the Cathedral of Seville. And this building that houses all the documents that surround the discovery and the colonization of the Americas was dedicated to Isabella, the Queen of Spain. And the wording was, to the missionary queen, Isabella the Catholic, who opened channel and direction to the apostolic impetus of a people, to the Spanish missionaries who, in the service of a universal destiny of salvation, were servants of Christ and expanded the inheritance of the world to the east and west under the sign of the cross. In this archive of the Indies, documentary treasure of our missionary epic, Spain guards the illustrious names of the propagators of the faith. I think that is a magnificent tribute to the missionaries that Columbus first brought over on his second voyage.
You know, it's amazing to me that the intensity of the spiritual motivation is lost. I mean, or let me put it this way. It's dismissed. It's frequently dismissed as simply so much pious rationalization for overweening ambition and greed. How do you respond to academics who claim something like that?
Well, as a historian, to try to reveal a balanced picture, because of the nature of the world, this is a fallen world, and every human endeavor has been tinged with limitations and sin.
Sure.
There's a dark side to every encounter between two cultures, and there's a bright side. Let's look at the dark side. If you look at the history of the world, you see the expression of man's desire to dominate and control his world as each rising culture displaces the one that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
And even when Columbus sailed into this part of the world, the cultures that he found there had displaced cultures before them. So there had been violence even in this part of the world. And, of course, he found signs of cannibalism on the island of Guadalupe in the Carib culture.
Hmm.
And, of course, Cortes later on discovered, to his horror, human sacrifice in the Aztec cultures. So there was a dark cloud over the cultures of the New World. And it's true that Columbus, on the second and third voyages, because there was so little gold to be found on Hispaniola, he did take some Indians back to Spain as slaves in direct disobedience to the Queen's order. She would have none of it and chastised him for that. Also, the tragic aspect of this encounter was that many of the Indian populations of those islands were nearly decimated, and most scholars point to the diseases that were brought over by the Europeans, such as influenza, measles, and smallpox.
And the indigenous people had not the antibodies to deal with these.
Exactly, yeah. And it wiped out whole cultures. And Columbus was a miserable administrator.
Okay.
And he was taken back in chains to Spain after the third voyage. But there's a bright side to this. Columbus was an absolutely fabulous navigator. And when you think that he would go out on the Sea of Darkness with just a compass and use dead reckoning to cross the Atlantic Ocean, you have to say that he's one of the greatest navigators that ever lived.
Hmm.
And he did it. And others might have done it, but nothing came from their discovery. Much came from his discovery. It changed the course of history. And there's a lot to admire in Columbus. We can admire his courage in the face of great adversity and deprivation. We can admire his devotion and faith in God, which was commented upon by Las Casas.
I was going to ask you about
that.
Yeah, Bishop Bartolomé de Las Casas was not afraid to criticize.
Absolutely not.
People. I mean,
he criticized Columbus for the policy of slavery that Columbus supported after the first and second voyages. But at the same time, he also said that Columbus, and I'm quoting from his great work, The History of the Indies, Columbus was a mature man of great spirit, valiant, of noble thoughts. He always held to a great faith in divine providence. And indeed, from what I've heard from my own father, who was with him when he returned with people to colonize this island of Hispaniola in 1493, that he had a great devotion to the king and queen and to the Christian religion, and was without a doubt a Catholic of great devotion. So here's a man that criticizes Columbus,
yes,
as he should have, or his succumbing to economic pressures and making slaves of the Indians, but he also describes him as a man of great faith. We can also admire Columbus's inquiring mind. He was an immensely educated man. We don't know if he had any education as a child formally, but he learned Latin. He studied geography books and other books that gave him the idea of his great enterprise. He had a very inquiring mind.
Hmm.
We can appreciate that his voyages brought together the two segments of the human race and brought about the new and robust races and cultures that came out of that. And we can admire and thank the Lord that the histories of Canada, the United States, and the numerous American republics were initiated by the voyages of Columbus. And in fact, we can admire the fact, and we've spoken about this, Al, that the great missionary movement that issued from this part of the world began with the second voyage of Christopher Columbus, when he brought with him the first missionaries to this to these lands.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's amazing the significance of his work, and amazing how it was done throughout his commitment to Christ. And I think that, in spite of the human person on this side of the fall is flawed. There's no doubt about it. We're like oftentimes like great masterpieces that have been vandalized in some way, and we need restoration. But still, there's something I find incredibly reassuring about the guidance of God, the providence of God in the life of this man.
I do too, Al. And you know, during the lifetime of Columbus, Christianity was in decline in Europe. And his voyage doubled the influence, expanded the influence of Christianity, and brought to these lands Judeo-Christian values.
Yes.
And if he had not discovered America, and others had, what would we be today?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. Given that the last Muslims were expelled from Spain that very year, 1492.
Yes.
What would they? Was there? Would there have been? Would this have been ever been a Muslim?
Well, the Muslims, the Arabs, were great navigators, they have the capability of making such a voyage. But I believe that in the sovereignty of God over human history, as a Christian, and I believe it was the hand of God in Christopher Columbus's life and in the lives of Ferdinand and Isabella, and in the history of Spain. And I believe that he used this man who made himself available to God's mission. He used him to bring the faith to the new world.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lesson here for us, that we need to be devoted to the faith in our land today, because Christianity is in decline in our country. And if Christians don't have a sense of mission and don't have a sense of love for our fellow men and women that do not know the Lord, then Christianity will decline.
Yes. Yeah. Kay, thank you very much. How can people follow up on this topic?
Anyone wants to talk to me about it, they can call me at 305-666-3844 in Miami, Florida. I will be glad to answer any questions if I can, and discuss this wonderful historical figure. He's my favorite, and that is Christopher Columbus, the stout-hearted man from Genoa who changed the course of history.
And that, Kay, your number again is 305-666-3844?
Correct.
Okay. We'll follow up, and on our website we'll also have your book posted there as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Happy Columbus Day, Al.
And to you, Kay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Kay Brigham, I'll tell you this. I began talking to Kay probably 10, 15 years ago now. And I try to talk to her at least once a year on Columbus Day, because this is a story that doesn't get told. One of the reasons I love continuing to do this broadcast and talk with you. Insights into the providence of God, his supernatural control, his superintending of history. All right, we'll have more at the AveMariaRadio.net website. I'm Al Cresta.
Need a plumber, roofer, or landscaper? For any of your home improvement needs, look first in the Catholic business pages. Before you shop anywhere else, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Catholic business pages link. Find reliable businesses you can trust.
At Ann Arbor State Bank, we share the Ann Arbor state of mind with you. We're the entrepreneurs with money to lend and the will to lend it. What does this mean to you, an area business owner? It means we welcome you with enthusiasm and ease of lending. It means our seasoned business bankers are proud to be your banker. That's Ann Arbor, and that's the Ann Arbor State Bank, financiers of the Ann Arbor state of mind. Located at 125 East William or A2SB.com. Member FDIC, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Brothers in Christ, the last of the 2009 Put Out Into the Deep Men's mini conferences for the year is upon us. It's Wednesday, October 14th at St. Francis Cabrini in Allen Park. Put the evening on your calendar now. It's a great opportunity to spend an instructive evening with your son, especially if they are of confirmation age, as they learn about the Sacrament of Reconciliation with Father Ben Lutke. It's also a wonderful time for your father to brush up on the Sacrament of the Anointing of the Sick with Father Daniel Trapp. Don't miss this opportunity. There will be a large number of priests on hand to administer these sacraments of healing. Our conference begins promptly at 7. We'll have an evening of prayer, fellowship, and deepening of our knowledge of the gifts our Lord has left for each of us. For more information and a map to the church, go to our website, ChristChosen.com. That's ChristChosen.com. Click on Men's Conference. It's a Put Out of the Deep Men's Mini Conference on the Sacraments of Healing on Wednesday, October 14th at St. Francis Cabrini in Allen Park. Information at ChristChosen.com.
Join our community of business owners and professionals who express strong Christian values. Consumers have an added sense of confidence when they find your business in the Catholic Business Pages. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Catholic Business Pages link.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. An essay by the mother of Columbine killer Dylan Klebold says that she had no inkling of her son's inner turmoil, and her examination of his journals has prompted her to learn about suicide in an effort to understand the school shooting. The essay by Susan Klebold will appear in the November issue of O, the Oprah magazine, and we'll explore her son's role in the 1999 massacre. No doubt you remember Columbine. It became the watershed event for understanding school violence, or at least for labeling school violence afterwards. It was April 20th of 1999, and two boys, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left an indelible stamp on our psyche. Nobody has studied Columbine more diligently or has spent as much emotional energy trying to understand the interior lives of both Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris than Dave Cullen. Dave is the author of Columbine, that is the definitive work on this tragedy. He's been covering and analyzing the Columbine massacre since he was there that day in 1999. Dave, good to have you back.
Hi, thanks for having me on again. You've been very good to me. I always enjoy talking to you, too.
Thank you. Susan Klebold has decided to at least submit an essay. This is the most any of the parents have said thus far about their son's involvement?
It is. It is. Yes, and I read the essay, and it's really moving. It's gut-wrenching. I had to read it very quickly before I did a TV spot, and I kept just getting stopped in my tracks because it's painful to read.
Now, when we talk, people always want to ask, why did they do it? That's the wrong question. These were two very different boys, very different young men, moving in opposite directions but coming together at a critical time for this tragedy. What was different between them?
Well, you got it right, and just about everything. Eric was cold and calculating, very unemotional about things. Dylan was the opposite. He was hot-blooded. He got angry very easily. All emotional, not so much reason. And, he was a very, very bright boy, but when he got something got to him, he acted based on emotion rather than, you know, his rational side. And the ego was so different. Eric was all ego. He suffered from, you know, a messianic level ego, thinking way too highly of himself and wanted to show people. Dylan was the opposite. Dylan had extremely low self-esteem, was beating himself up constantly in his journal, and was suicidal. And that's the biggest thing. And I think Sue Klebold really got that in her essay, that she said she didn't understand this or really believe it. She said she was in denial for the first 6 months after the murders until she saw Dylan's writings and realized how much of it was a suicide for him, that he was wanting to kill himself long before he went into that school, and that's what he did that day, in addition to a terrible thing of a vengeful suicide of taking other people with him.
They had very different attitudes toward the world. Eric wanted it destroyed so he could reign, I guess.
Right, right, or, right. Or just have it gone and have wielded his power over us.
Yeah.
It was very much a power trip for him.
Dylan, on the other hand, actually loved the world.
He did, and he loved people, and he was very much a seeker, and he saw beauty in the world and an experience. He wanted to experience everything. He wanted to be on the side of good, and what he referred to repeatedly as the everlasting struggle between good and evil. He wanted to be a good boy. He just felt he kept getting rejected by the world and by everyone in it, and it was it was tearing him apart, and he felt like we kept turning our backs on him.
And so he felt justified striking back?
You know, well, that's the hardest part to understand, because it isn't clear. He's torn all the way through, and he never really tells us why exactly. It's an interesting word of justifying. He never actually expresses it that way, that he feels justified. More likely that he just wanted to show us how he felt and how people often are with suicides of like, well, they'll see after, you know, they find my body and they'll see just how mean they were to me. You know, I think Sue has one really crucial there was an epiphany for me in her essay where she's talking about that very subject and how a lot of the things Dylan was thinking, he probably understood some of it was irrational and that he was very conflicted and needed somebody to talk about this to. And I'll just read you one line, if I can, from her essay where she says, I just looked at the wrong page. Give me one second. Tore a piece off.
Dave Cullen is my guest. He's the author of Columbine. It is the definitive work on the tragedy from April of 1999. Susan Klebold, Dylan Klebold's mother, has written an essay for O Magazine exploring her son's role in the massacre. And David has access to the essay.
Thank you. Okay, I found the passage. She writes, I believe that Dylan did not want to talk about his thoughts because he was ashamed of having them.
Really?
And that's a very simple idea, but I think that's really profound. And as soon as I read it, I thought, oh, God, exactly. You know, he doesn't ever say that, obviously, in his journal, but I almost can't believe that didn't occur to me because it really does, that really does ring true from the Dylan I've seen from his videos and from his journals. And I think he did realize that some of this was irrational, and he needed to help. And, you know, God help us, the last person in the world he should have been sharing his feelings with were Eric Harris.
What was it about his upbringing, his home environment, that might have led him to have such intense shame over those feelings?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know that nothing jumps out at me from anyone I've ever spoken to. It seemed to be a loving family.
Yeah.
The only thing I could think is he had very high standards for himself. His parents really stressed how bright he was, what an achiever he could be, and he may have felt like he was letting them down, like he wasn't measuring up. I just read an interesting book, Nurture Shock, about that and about the studies that parents believe they really give their kids confidence by telling them repeatedly how good they are, how successful they are, how smart they are, and that kids respond the opposite way, that they just feel more pressure and then they believe then, okay, I'm an A student, and if I ever get a B plus, then I fail. And
I'll
it actually works against their confidence. So
maybe that's what this was about. Dave, thank you so much. How's Columbine doing, the book?
It's doing really well. It's still selling. It was 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's still getting a good reaction, particularly, thank goodness, from most of the families.
Good. Thank you, Dave. Dave Cullen.
On October 13, 1917, the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared in Fatima, Portugal, before a crowd of over 70,000 people, believers and non-believers alike, who witnessed the sun spinning and dancing in the sky. Tens of thousands of people fell to their knees and gave their lives to Christ on that very spot. It was reported widely by the press, and to this day, no one has ever been able to discredit the reality of what occurred. It's been called the miracle of the sun. On Tuesday night, October the 13th, you too can witness this miracle when Ave Maria Radio presents The 13th Day, a beautiful new film by Ian and Dominic Higgins that tells the full story of Our Lady of Fatima. Unlike most movies that deal with Christian themes, this movie has been filmed through the lens of faith. Shot on location in Portugal and in the UK, The 13th Day is a remarkable retelling of the story of Fatima as seen through the eyes of Sister Lucia Santos, the last remaining person to have seen Our Lady at Fatima. This is a pre-screening of a film that won't be released until December of this year. You can be among the first to see it. The movie will be shown at Our Lady of Good Counsel Church in Plymouth, home of Ave Maria Radio's own Father John Ricardo. Admission is free. A free will offering will be taken to help support Ave Maria Radio. Doors open at 6:30 and the presentation begins at 7:30. Seating is limited and is available on a first-come, first-served basis only, so there is no reserve seating. Again, the doors open at 6:30 p.m. That's Tuesday, October the 13th, at Our Lady of Good Counsel Church, located on North Territorial Road, just west of Beck, near the intersection of Beck and M14 in Plymouth. Come see the 13th day. Come support Ave Maria Radio. Be prepared to see a miracle.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Dave Cullen's book, Columbine, available in our online bookstore at avemariaradio.net. It's an incredible, incredible read. Now, on the other side of the break, I'll have a few comments about, again, the spiritual dimension of the Columbine massacre, because the occasion for it is Dylan Klebold's mother finally contributing an essay to O Magazine describing what amounts to the suicidal depression of her son Dylan, who was one of the two of the Columbine terrorists. Now, also coming up in the next hour, we'll be joined by Dr. Monica Miller, who was profiled in this weekend's New York Times.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
In the secular world, it's a day set aside to honor fathers. And yet, there are remarkable religious connotations to Father's Day. On our next program, Father John Ricardo delves into the true meaning of fatherhood and what it really means to be a father. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Faith, family, and the culture of life. It's Family Man with Catholic therapist Dr. Gregory Popchak.
There are few challenges more, well, challenging than being a great Catholic parent, and fewer saints could provide a better inspiration than St. John Bosco. Charged with educating the toughest juvenile delinquents of his day, Don Bosco experienced a vision from God that told him how to succeed with love. As part of his system of gentle correction, Don Bosco might be credited as the first promoter of the timeout,